is an accredited practicing dietitian and nutritionist, currently completing her PhD and working as a research assistant at the Food and Mood Centre. After graduating from Monash with first class honours in her nutrition and dietetics degree, Megan worked as a clinical dietitian before she eventually found her passion to lie in nutrition psychiatry research. Her research interests focus on the role of diet, particularly dairy consumption, in common mental disorders and cognition. Megan is also extensively involved with research translation at the Food and Mood Centre and has delivered quite a number of workshops and cooking demonstrations, particularly aimed at school-aged children. We are honoured to have Megan here with us today, giving an insight into this emerging field of nutrition. Please welcome Megan.
Hi Meg, welcome. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Thanks for having me on today. I'm really excited to speak to you both.
Oh, we're very excited to have you here with us today. Now, to start off, we always ask our guests some quick fire questions. So the first question is, are you a restaurant or home cooking kind of person? If so, what's your favourite place or dish?
I'd have to say that I'm a bit more on the home cook side of thing, although the idea of going out to eat at a restaurant has been exciting. I'm down in Geelong, so recently we've got to go back to a little bit of normality with COVID, so that has been something that I really enjoyed. But on the whole, I love cooking at home, and probably my favourite thing to cook would be Mexican. So earlier this year, right before COVID happened, we got to, my partner and I snuck a new trip to Mexico, which was pretty good. So lots of tacos, lots of burrito bowls and things like that at our house.
Yeah, that sounds delicious. Our second question is, what have you enjoyed most about isolation?
I think this has changed a lot throughout stage one and stage two, and I've gone through phases, I'm sure a lot of people have. So I went through the cooking phase, which I really loved. Now we're just about to, we're in the middle of renovating our house, so I've really enjoyed having the time to focus on that a little bit more, picking out the things and the design side of things, but definitely slowing down and having more time to focus on the things that we probably wouldn't get to enjoy day to day as much has been really nice.
Yeah, 100% agree. Our third question is, what have you been consuming recently, either a book, a show or an article?
Last night, it was really good to watch Richmond Footy Club win. AFL, that has been good coming into final season. And then I have been trying to read a bit. I'm not sure, something to do with isolation. I found it quite hard to stick to a book. I've recently purchased a Kindle, so it's a lot easier to start a book, put it down, start a new book and so forth. But I have just started reading Girl with Woman Other. So that won the Booker Prize last year. So very excited to dig into that. Have you both read that?
Charlotte.
I've read it, yeah. I loved it.
Okay, good. Yeah. I'll have to stick with this one then and not stop halfway through.
So it's very interestingly written.
Yeah, I have noticed that from the start. Yep. So it should be good. Have some time.
You're both convincing me now. I need to go.
No, you're outvoted now. I think you have to get on it.
So our fourth question is, what is one thing we can't find out about you online?
Oh, I don't think I'm very interesting as a person. I don't know. I have always played piano. So growing up, I did all my exams playing piano. So that's something I've quite enjoyed. I've lost touch with that a little bit recently, but something I'm pick up a little bit more in the future. But yeah, probably wouldn't find that about me online.
Nice. And our final question is, what did you want to be when you were a child?
It was definitely a vet. I've always loved animals. And until I did a placement working at the vets or the local vets, and I saw that you always saw sick animals and it probably wasn't as glamorous as you thought in your head. That's when I looked at other career alternatives. But yeah, I've always had that passion and love for animals. Got two dogs at home with me myself. So yeah, I think having the dogs and rather than looking after and treating sick dogs all the time is probably a better alternative for me.
Nice. Now, speaking of careers, we're going to start at the beginning of yours. And we want to know, what initially sparked your interest in nutrition?
I don't think there was ever one big thing that happened that was like the light bulb moment for me. I've always loved food. So I remember from a young age, my grandma, so I come from a German background, and my Uma was always a big cook. So I loved getting into the kitchen with her and cooking as I grew up. And that passion kind of continued with my dad as well. We always used to cook together. So I think by the time it came to, say, that year 10, year 11, and you had to start thinking about, oh God, what am I going to do after all this high school thing finishes, I was looking for somewhere where I could continue my passion for food. And I didn't think the chef or the cooking lifestyle really suit me well. And I was also a big runner growing up. I was really into my sports and cross-country running. So I think having something that was a little bit more health orientated as well and combining that with food, that's, yeah, when I spoke to the career counsellor, nutrition and dietetics seemed like a no-brainer for me at that time.
Yeah. And during your degree, what areas did you enjoy the most? And what did you struggle with?
Areas I really liked. I really liked the public health side of things, I think. We had some amazing lecturers that really made it an exciting topic to learn. And I had a really great placement. A few of my friends and I got to go to Ballarat and we lived down there for a couple of months in a house together. So it was kind of like a bit of a girls' trip where we all got to travel. And I think that made it a really nice experience. And you got to think of these big picture problems as well. And could think of a little bit more outside the box, which I like to do. So the public health side of things is really always interesting to me. Areas I struggled with, definitely the workload, I think, starting first year, second year. There's just a lot of heavy science. And as much as I enjoy that, I was living on res at the time, so at Monash. So I was living on campus. And so I was kind of trying to juggle that social life with coming home every night and having massive amount of work, having to revise content and to keep on top of it all. And I mean, I was living with med students and I felt I was doing more work than them half the time. But yeah, I think definitely those first 2 years, I really struggled just with the workload. I did enjoy it, but just the amount of content was quite challenging.
What all were you at out of interest? Because I've lived on res for the past year and a half.
I was at Mannix.
I had, we had a few friends, a few nutrition students from Mannix in our cohort.
I loved it. It was definitely 1 year was enough for me, I think. Studying nutrition and then balancing that with going out and partying a lot was a bit of a contradiction a lot of the time. There was a few Thursday mornings I remember what was it, the science labs that we had, and I'd rock in a little bit dustier than everyone else, and I was probably, well, there was only a few of us that lived at res on the time, but it was a great experience, and I really enjoyed it as a whole.
Oh, that's really nice. And you touched on placements, so can you tell us a little bit more about that? How did you get them, and kind of where did that lead to?
So we had, I'm sure you've probably been introduced to them before, but we had a public health placement, like I mentioned. So we worked out at Ballarat Community Health, three girls and I, and we were tasked with developing a food hub. So the centralised food system for the Ballarat region that would connect the community to local producers, basically. So what would happen within regional Victoria, particularly, so you have your growers, and then a lot of the fruits and vegetables and all the produce would come to Melbourne, and then it would get centralised. And so they would do all the packing and things like that there. And then it would go back out to Ballarat. So it's a very inefficient system. So rather we were trying to cut down on that by creating a local food hub. So it's similar to like your farmer's market, but where the community could go directly to purchase produce. And from that sustainable perspective as well, it would cut down on food miles. So that was a really interesting task. We had a great team at Ballarat Community Health that we loved working with, and a really great supervisor there. And we also got to enjoy the cafes and the restaurants in Ballarat. So it made it just a little bit more of a, it was a nice lifestyle for a while there when we moved away. So I think if you do have the opportunity to travel for placement and to live elsewhere, definitely take on that opportunity. I think we were a bit hesitant at the start, just thinking we're going to have to relocate, but the experience we had, we found, was very enriching as a result. Other placements I had was at Wantirna Health, and that's where I had a food service placement. It's probably something that didn't resonate as much with me. We did a lot of and we did an order of plate wastage. So we would capture, so we'd use, gosh, it's going back now. I should probably remember. It wasn't that far. I should probably remember, but we were looking at plate wastage. So once the patient had finished eating, we would look at that plate, measure how much, and it's more was from, I suppose, a cost effectiveness point of view. So looking at how we could cut down on food waste to improve the hospital food system. And then I went into clinical placement, and both of those I had at Monash Health. So for me, I think working both at Monash Health was great because that meant that I got to know a lot of their dietitians there, and I formed some really good relationships. And I think that was quite instrumental in me ending up landing a grad position at Monash Health in the end. Yeah.
So interesting. And during your time of your degree, what you said you went out of it, what other kind of extracurricular activities did you get involved with?
I remember I did quite a few. So what else? I did work for a little bit with Nutrition Australia doing a few admin things there. So they were based in Carlton at the time. I think they might still be there now. But I did some admin tasks like developing resources with them, and then also cooking demonstrations. So I went out to Colac one day and did some within Melbourne to a couple of corporate organisations. And that was a good experience just to get a different perspective working within a non-for-profit organisation. And then I suppose what's more pivotal to my career now is that when I was studying at Monash, I came across a study that was around food and mood. And a lot of you might know that as a SMILES trial. So there was a recruitment ad out at the time for participants, and I saw there was an email on the recruitment ad, and blindly just messaged the researchers involved saying, hey, I'm really interested in this type of research. I hadn't at that time really found something that I was really passionate about continuing. My degree, I wasn't really sure where I wanted to go at that time. And when I came across this area of research, because it was so new, I found it quite fascinating. So trying to find a way to get involved, I emailed the dietitian involved, who turned out to be Rochelle Opie, who was a lead dietitian on the SMILES trial, and then started interning and working with them on that study. So that, I think, was quite pivotal because after, or which we can get into later, but I think the relationships I formed while working as an intern on the SMILES trial has really led to where I am today.
Oh, that's really nice.
Maybe you can tell us a little bit about the SMILES trial now, just to give anyone some context that, you know, doesn't really know what it's about, and then we can go into it a little bit more later.
Yeah, absolutely. So the SMILES trial is basically, as it was a randomized controlled trial, it was the world first study that really looked at the research question saying, answering if you change your diet, could you improve your mood? It was in a clinical sample of adults with depression, and so it was mainly run in Melbourne, but I think it was also a site in Adelaide. And the researchers randomised participants into one or two groups. So one group received dietary advice from a dietitian over 12 weeks. And the second received, it was called a social support control. So basically it was a befriending protocol where participants would go and meet with research assistant and talk to them. And the purpose of that was, because in dietary research, it's really hard to see. You want to compare whether there's any differences and whether that's due to the intervention, the changes in the diet itself, or whether people's mood are improving just because they're speaking and talking to people, because that's a possibility as well. So that was why we had that social support and control in there. And as part of the 12-week diet protocol, participants were encouraged to follow this Mediterranean-style diet. So it was a diet that was really high in plant-based foods, so legumes, fruit, seeds, nuts and vegetables, and little bits of red meat and dairy as well. And it also emphasised limiting processed foods and those discretionary items. So what they found at the end of the 12 weeks, after there was about 60 participants on the trial, I think there was 66, I should probably know the numbers a little bit more off the top of my head by now, but they found that in those who were within the diet group, around 30% of those significantly reduced their, don't quote me on that number, actually there was a significant reduction in depressive symptoms, so that a large proportion of participants within that diet group achieved what was called clinically, they achieved remission criteria for depression. So using the diagnostic tool, so this depression scale involved in the study, they were no longer clinically diagnosed as depressed. Wow. They were still on medication, so they were still seeking other treatments. So that's really important to always discuss in this field of nutritional psychiatry. We're not suggesting that diet is a cure-all, but it may be a small part as part of a larger treatment pathway for those with mental disorders. So yeah, it was really a groundbreaking study at the time. It was the first one led by Professor Felice Jacku, who's really pioneered this field of nutritional psychiatry and has set the stage for a lot of the research now that we're doing at the Food and Mood Centre.
Oh, that's wonderful. Yeah, that's, and what year was that conducted?
So the findings from that were published in 2017. So it was around that, maybe 2015 to 2016.
Because the way it sounds, it's just, it's quite emerging, it's quite new stuff.
Yeah.
But it's, we sometimes forget how new the nutrition and dietetics field is, and we're still learning. And it's amazing you got to be a part of that.
Yeah, it was a very small role. My part in that was analysing FoodWorks diaries. So I was by no means one of the head researchers. I was an intern, and it was really led by Rochelle and Felice. Mm. And they were the key contributors, but it was nice to get an insight into research, and it definitely sparked that interest for me.
We'll wrap up this section by just asking, coming out of uni, were you ready for that steep learning curve? Was there a steep learning curve, and were you ready? Were you all excited about research?
I was, but I started off in clinical first. So I was actually at that stage, I had always thought I wanted to get experience clinically. I think it was something that was reiterated throughout our degree at the time, that if you could get clinical experience at the start, it would really set you up to do whatever you wanted. Mm-hmm. And that's not saying that's the only pathway to take, but I thought if I could get some clinical experience first, I think it would really put me in a position to kind of work out what I really wanted to do. Still by then, I hadn't even considered doing a PhD. It was not even on my radar. So it's something I can talk to a little bit later, but I just stumbled into that at the end of the day. I don't think you'll ever be prepared. I don't think any new graduate, no matter what field you are in, is really prepared. It is a big jump, especially going into clinical work. I mean, my placement at the end, I finished up at a subacute. I was down at Kingston at Monash Health, and I felt quite competent there. I was doing a lot of managing my own caseload, and when I walked out of that, my last placement, I felt like I had been on top of things there. But then I started off within an acute setting when I was in my grad role, so I went straight to Monash Medical Center, and that's just a different world. My caseload there was mainly nasogastric feeds, so I was working on the neurosurgical and stroke wards, and I had barely done any feeds. Well, I had done no feeds, I think, at Kingston when I was there. So there was definitely a bit of a panic moment there when I found out that was my caseload, but you adapt, and I think you just get through it.
We'll move on to the next section and look at your career now. So you've actually kind of just described a few of your next steps after graduating from university. Could you tell us a little bit more about how you did land that first graduate role, and then how you kind of did settle into that intense caseload? Like, what were kind of the things that probably helped you do that? Was there a mentor, or how did you go about that process of really stepping into a much more difficult and intense role?
So I think I mean you just show up to interviews, you apply for as many jobs as you can at the time. You really don't know what way the wind's going to blow when you graduate, so you just kind of put your hand up for everything. And that's the approach I really took throughout my degree as well. If opportunities came, you find out what you like and you don't like by doing that as well. So saying yes to things that come your way, I think, is really useful. So I went along to the interview. I got lucky that I got the job. So as a graduate at Monash, you do a rotation. So you start at one site and then you rotate to another site. So I started off at Monash Medical Center with another new graduate who was from Deakin University at the time. And then we were allocated a caseload. So mine was the neuro ward, as I said, and the stroke ward. And then the other dietitian had Gen Med, I think it was, at the time. And you are buddied up with the supervisor at work, so at Monash Health, and we both had a supervisor that would oversee our work. And we did also get a handover from the new graduates from the year before, which was really helpful as well. So we got to spend a day with them, or maybe even a bit longer now, but you wish you could have had a month because there was so much to learn. They were just trying to give you as much information as knowledge as they can. And they were really great though as well. They gave us their email. So if we had any questions after they left, they were so open to helping us at the same time. So we had supervisors at work, but then also we had, as part of the DAA mentorship program, so the Dietitians Association of Australia, which is called Dietitians Australia now, I think, you have to go through and get a supervisor yourself. So I was quite lucky. I had the amazing Simone Gibson as my supervisor, and her clinical experience was amazing. She had previously worked at Dandenong at Monash Health, so knew what I was going through as well. So I met up with her quite frequently at the same time as well. And so having someone within work, but also someone outside of the hospital system, I think was really good to help debrief as well. And I could raise a few more personal issues I felt with Simone as well. So that way I felt that I was adequately supervised, and that was really good, which I think is so important when you first graduate too, because you have all the knowledge, but at the same time, you don't know what you're doing half the time.
Yeah, it's such a different environment to university and to like, no longer being taught that you are the clinician.
Yes, exactly. And you are, I suppose, given free rent. So you go, my first day, you start your day by going to ward rounds. And I was so quiet for the first month or two. So I was like, I'm just the new dietitian. I don't know anything. But gradually your confidence builds, and you have your pages. So if you ever get stuck, you can message your supervisor as well. So there's so many dietitians within the hospital system that there's always someone to ask a question, which I think is so great and one of the big advantages. So you just learn so quickly when you're there.
Can you tell us a bit about your transition from clinical dietetics to now research? So how did that come about?
That came about by a phone call, really. One day I was working clinically and I was I still had stayed in contact with the little, I was keeping my eye on the food and mood research. It was something that I just wanted to keep on the back of the burner. I thought once I was working clinically, maybe I could specialize in mental health. But at the time I was finding, this was still, it was only a couple of years ago, but there wasn't really much out there. I mean, this landscape has changed now, but there wasn't a whole lot out there for where you could upskill in the area of mental health. And I was trying to seek out webinars, trying to seek out knowledge of where I can, while I was working clinically, to build my skills in that area, but found that there wasn't a whole lot. And so one day Felice had called me, Professor Felice Jaffa, sorry, and said there was a PhD opportunity that was already funded at the Food and Mood Centre, would I be interested? And I had never considered a PhD. To be honest, I didn't really know what a PhD entailed when I had said I'd consider it. But I was living in Melbourne at the time and my partner was down in Geelong. I'd grown up in Geelong and the Food and Mood Centre happened to be located in Geelong. So that was another draw card for saying, yes, I got to move back home. And I just thought, well, it's going to be the perfect opportunity to learn about this area. If I say no now, will another opportunity present itself? And as much as I enjoyed working in the clinical space, I couldn't see myself being there long term. It was a great learning experience, but it, for me, I just knew that clinical wasn't where I wanted to take my career. So I think it was just a leap of faith, I think. In the end, and so I said yes to police, had a couple of meetings and started there later that year.
And did you do any private practice around that time as well, or did you go straight from clinical to research?
Straight from clinical to research. I don't even think I had a break in between. I went from one job straight into research. I did dabble with some private practice within a lab. Oh, I have since I've started my PhD, really, down in Geelong. And have seen patients in a couple of clinics, most recently in an allied health clinic, where I was focusing more on mental health and some gut issues, but also a lot of chronic diseases. But I've just found the balance working, it's basically running your own business, trying to get your own marketing, making sure you get your doctor's letters, the balance of juggling private practice with PhD for me. I'm someone that I like to give 100% to anything I do. And I felt that I was compromising a little bit on both. So I was probably giving like 80% to both. And I just felt I'm never going to get my PhD done. At one point I was like, I'm never going to get this done. So I've just decided at this point in time to make the focus just on research and finalizing my PhD, hopefully by next year. And then we'll see whether it takes me back into private practice.
So let's dive into your PhD. Can you tell us what are you doing? What are you studying? What does it look like?
So when Felice called me, she had initially mentioned that there was funding for this PhD student to work on a trial that was looking at the differences between A2 milk or A2 beta casein dairy products versus conventional dairy products. So those that contain the A1 and the A2 beta casein protein. So have you learned much about that, or do you have a good idea the differences between the two? I can run it. Okay, yeah, I will try to do my best by doing it nice and short. But basically, around 5,000 to 10,000 years ago, there was this genetic mutation that occurred in cows. So originally all cows produced just this protein called A2 beta casein. But after this genetic mutation, their milk contained a mixture of common cows, contained a mixture of A1 and A2. So nowadays, most of the milk we consume is this combined A1 and A2 milk, whereas you can also purchase just your A2 only milk, which you'll see everywhere on ads at the moment, especially if you watch the blog. And so the main difference between this is that when A1 is digested in the gut, it releases a small opioid-like peptide, which is called beta-casein morphine 7 or BCM7. And so as the name suggests, it kind of behaves like morphine in the body. So there have been a couple of clinical trials to show that compared to those who consume A2 milk, those who consume regular milk have higher levels of inflammation and oxidative stress. And they also have altered gut function. And all three, so oxidative stress, inflammation, and gut, are kind of implicated in mental disorders. So what we're trying to see is whether swapping from regular milk or regular milk and cheese to A2 only, so taking out the A1 protein, whether that has any implications for, say, psychological distress, but also a whole range of other outcomes, so like sleep, the gut microbiota composition, cognition. And so the focus of my PhD was looking at these mental health and brain outcomes, so cognition, psych, distress, where I was also lucky enough to be working with another PhD student on the project who looked at more that gut side of things and body composition. But as you know, COVID has come in, so my PhD has taken, we've had to stop recruiting for that clinical trial at the moment. So now I'm looking more broadly at, say, dairy consumption and the link between mood and cognition. So working on an epidemiological paper, so that's where you look at data sets. So one of my supervisors is from Finland, which is another cool thing about research is that you get to work with people right across the world. You get to travel lots and form these friendships outside of Australia. So I'm working with her with a data set in Finland and looking at differences between men in Finland who they actually have a really high intake of dairy. So their average intake is something around 800 grams a day of dairy, whereas in Australia, it's probably around 250. So it's a population that's quite unique. They love their milk and their dairy, especially fermented dairy. So I'm looking at whether there's any differences in those who consume fermented and then non-fermented dairy sources, and whether that influences the risk for depression long-term. Because what we've found in a study that's conducted in Geelong women is that postmenopausal women, one of them, women who consumed over 250 mils of milk a day, so a glass of milk you're thinking here, were at an increased risk of developing depression. So that's just been shown in one sample. So it's not cause and effect. It's an observational study. So we need to consider that. But hopefully with the research we do, we can draw out whether there is any relationship between dairy, because as you know, it is quite contentious. A lot of people think, say, it's good for you, great for your bones. But then other studies have found, say, increased health risks associated with dairy, say, for like cancer and things like that.
Can I ask, with that study, when you refer to dairy, are you referring to just animal-based products, or are you looking, taking into account plant-based products as well?
Is this for the clinical trial?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So cow's milk products. products. Yeah. So interestingly, so sheep's and goat's yogurt and milk don't contain that A1 protein. So we're specifically mainly looking at the cow's milk products here. And there are a couple of other things in cow's milk that might increase the risk for depression that we're looking at. But yeah, at this stage, it's all quite speculative. We need to get the research done to see.
And how does a PhD work in the, we've interviewed a few people that have completed PhDs and PhD candidates, and they all describe the process quite differently, because obviously it's very dependent on what you're studying and the type of research you're doing.
Yep.
But do you have multiple studies on the go, or do you dedicate your time to, say, one clinical trial? Like, how does it work in terms of, it's a huge, research question. How do you go about kind of planning it and, actually executing it?
That's such a great question. And I think for everyone will answer this differently, because there is really no set right or wrong way. And I mean, answer honestly, I had no idea what a PhD really was before starting. So I knew what research was. We had done some research subjects because I went through with the embedded honours degree. I was quite lucky that I had that research experience. So I kind of thought I'd be doing a lot of stats. I just thought PhD, you'll be sitting down, you're doing lots of stats, which kind of terrified me a little bit because it was never my strength. But so my main focus was going to be working on this clinical trial. So there's two options at Deakin. I'm not so sure about other universities, but you can do, say, like a PhD by publication, where you can publish research papers, combine them together with like a bit of info, like an intro discussion, and gel everything together. And that can be your thesis. Or you can do, say, more of just a narrative thesis, say, focus on the one clinical trial and write that up. So mine is that the PhD by publication, where I've written a systematic review. I'm looking at an epi data set as well. And then I'll also have a little bit of clinical trial data in there too. And by doing that, I think I really broadened my skill set as well in your experience. So it depends what you want to get out of your PhD. I think I'm someone that likes to learn and challenge myself. So I probably haven't picked the easier route for me by trying to learn epidemiology and clinical trials within the one, but it is quite hard. I mean, as a dietitian, we know that it's not the easiest to get a job. Like, sometimes you hear about how dim the job prospects are, but for research as well, it is quite competitive still. So being a dietitian and in research, I feel like I've made things extra challenging for myself, but yeah, I think by hopefully doing a mix of study design, so looking at both, that it might help to improve my skill set in the future.
And yeah. Is your research quite kind of quantitative, or is there still qualitative aspects in there? Like, how, because I guess mental health and mood, like there's, yeah, it's so multifaceted, and say, sleep quality can be measured in, different ways and through talking to people and mood. And like, it's, yeah, how does it kind of work? We're doing a research methods unit at the moment, so it's really interesting to see how it's actually applied and the different lenses that you would apply in real life.
No, that's a great question as well. So mostly all my data I deal with is quantitative. But I think that's excellent. What you've raised is so true, that you ignore those qualitative perspectives. And I think the qualitative data gives that real rich information that you're not able to capture with, say, a questionnaire at times. So there is one or two PhD students incorporating qualitative research questions into their PhD. And I'm looking forward to seeing what they find, because I think it is an important part of research. But definitely in my field, the quantitative research is a lot more common.
And can you walk us through your typical week as a researcher? So we've talked about your PhD quite conceptually, but what does it look like on the everyday level?
So I suppose I'll probably talk to more before COVID, because that would give you a bit more of a normal perspective. And it kind of changes as well during what stage of your PhD you are. So at the start of my PhD, I was doing a lot more of study design work. So I was involved in the design of the protocol for this clinical trial that I'm working on. So that involved a lot of meetings, a lot of going back and forth, talking to different people, trying to find out, is this the right way that we should be collecting information on dairy? So how are we going to actually see whether people are adhering or sticking to this diet? Is there a good tool or is there a good app that we can use? Or say, is a better, like a paper diary going to be a better option? So we probably spent about a year working out. They seem like some basic research things, but it takes a lot of time to develop a really robust clinical trial. So although that you read the findings within, say, 5 minutes, there's years and years of work that goes behind clinical trials. Where I am in my PhD at the moment is around that 3-year mark. So before COVID, my day to day would be doing your admin stuff, I suppose, at the start of the day. And then I would be seeing a lot of patients, so at participants. So I'd be going across to the hospital where we would see participants, meet with them. And as part of that appointment, I would do a screening questionnaire to see if they were eligible. Because my outcomes of the study were related to cognition, probably a skill set that a lot of dietitians or they wouldn't have had any experience with is cognitive tests. So I ran a cognitive battery, which was on a laptop. And so it was about a half an hour test that I would do with participants as well. So with a mouse testing how quickly they reacted to tasks. And so that's an area that I really got to learn as well, all these different psychometric assessments. And then once I'd finished with that appointment, I'd go back. You would look, probably try to read as many papers as you can, research papers, to stay up to date. There's a lot of computer work. My poor eyes have gone downhill, I think, since I've started a PhD. But and then writing as well, so writing manuscripts. So although I was working on this clinical trial, I was still trying at the same time in my downtime, write a systematic review. So doing that systematic screening, which is often in pairs as well, so you get to work with other researchers on that. And yeah, so it's not as glamorous as you would expect a lot of time. You do get to see participants though, so a lot of it is computer work. I think what I did struggle with was going from working in the hospital where I was on my feet all day, running from ward to ward and being really up and about to just sitting at a laptop was really quite challenging. But I think what I missed a lot of the time working clinically was that I wasn't learning a lot of the new research and keeping abreast with that. I just didn't have time. So having that time to keep on top of studies and to actually read new interesting information, it's really stimulating, I think, working in that side of things.
And speaking of time, I was just curious, how have you managed to, yes, stay on top of it and balance all these like projects and all the activities you do with like, yeah, personal life and, you know, looking into more research as well?
So I think research is one of those things that work-life balance can quickly go out the window. And you see a lot of researchers as well that will work late nights over the weekend because it is such a competitive field. I've made the decision. I love my work-life balance a little bit too much. So I try to keep my work just between weekdays. And I think just prioritising tasks at the start. My PhD, I would say yes to everything because I know that really good opportunities can come from that. But really now as I'm nearing towards the end, picking those opportunities that are really most pertinent, I suppose, to my research and not saying yes to everything and spreading yourself too thin is really important. We're quite lucky at the Food and Mood Centre though that you do get involved in a lot of other research projects. So I've got to contribute to a whole lot of other research studies, say on one recent paper was on fermented foods and mental health and anorexia nervosa. Another one, I've looked at nutraceuticals and multiple sclerosis, so very different to my field, but I'm getting to learn all these different other conditions and how the research applies there. So it's quite interesting that you get, it's not just looking at dairy and mental health all day, which I think would drive me a little bit crazy. So for my insanity, I do try and work quite collaboratively and work with others in the centre as well. So you get a bit more variety.
And just to wrap up this section, what excites you most about your research? Like what do you kind of, yeah, what excites you, what motivates you to kind of get up and do it every day? Since, as you said, like it's work-life balance can be thrown off. It's a very competitive, like there's, yeah, you've got to be very committed to complete a PhD and be a researcher.
Yeah, I think you have to be very self-motivated. And I think that, especially with COVID, it is a little bit harder because you're just rolling out of bed to your laptop a lot of the days. But I think the bigger picture, keeping that in mind, can help drive me a little bit. I am, as well as nutrition, I am quite passionate about mental health. At the same time, I've had family members that have been touched by mental health issues. So I think knowing the difference that nutrition can make to mental health, and particularly when talking about dairy, how widely consumed it is, even if it is just a small piece of the picture, I think contributing to the health of people and to helping to improve the lives of others is what can, or what really motivates me at the end of the day.
And I'm going to ask them some question from that. I know that you haven't finished your PhD yet, but what are the sorts of clinical kind of implications that can come out of, you know, PhDs out of the Food and Mood Centre? Like, what are some of the things that can, you know, that can happen once the research is complete?
Mm-hmm. Well, it depends on what type of study it is. I mean, from my study, looking at from an epidemiological perspective, so looking at the differences between fermented and non-fermented dairy sources, if there is a difference in that, it's not going, because it isn't a clinical trial, it doesn't show cause and effect, it's not going to actually change clinical practice. It's more going to form the grounds for future research. So say I find something there, it might warrant further studies as, say, like a clinical trial. But for those doing clinical trial research, I think, say if you're looking at a big dietary intervention, I mean, the work from the SMILES trial, you can look at that. What's happening now is that we're advocating and lobbying with the government to have dietitians included in part of the Medicare items for those who are seeking mental health treatment. So we do really need more studies in the area, but that's the type of things that clinical trial data can do. It can help to change practice guidelines, and it can help to transform the health system if you have enough of it to form a solid ground. That say, a lot of the work we're doing now is on training health professionals in the area of, say, psychiatrists in the area of nutrition. So it really is, if you look towards the SMILES trial and the other clinical trials that are coming out, there is bigger studies looking at the effects of diet and mental health. I think 5 years ago, we probably wouldn't have even been speaking about this subject. But if you do a short Google search now for food and mood, it really is coming to the mind of people as well. So, yeah, from a public health perspective, I think research is really, really important.
Absolutely. It's great to just hear that from, you know, from someone that's in it and doing, and obviously our lecturers are all, you know, have PhDs and are doing it, but it's just, it's great to hear kind of you're in the process, what can happen after. I think that's, and it just really puts all of the pieces of the puzzle together a bit more as well.
Yeah, and I think on that subject of PhDs and what can happen after as well, if you look at a curve, so of those who stay in research after completing a PhD, it's really, really small. So a lot of PhD candidates won't actually stay in research after completion. And that's due to like a number of things like funding. There's not a whole lot of government funding invested into research. And just the competitiveness can turn it and throw you a few people, spit them out research quite quickly. But having a PhD, I mean, it can specialise you to work in private practice in a sector. You can go off and work in industry. There's all these other career pathways you can take. So even if you're thinking of doing a PhD and aren't interested in staying in research, that's completely fine because it can take you in so many other places, like to working with the government or NGOs as well.
Where would you like to go after you finish
your PhD? Oh, I wish I knew the answer, but for now I am really enjoying research. I think as part of my role with the Food and Mood Centre, I've done a lot of community translation work, so working with schools in particular. So I've developed quite a number of presentations with colleagues, and we presented to secondary schools on the importance of diet and mental health. And for me, that's, I think, something that strikes a chord, because around half of all mental disorders are formed by the age of 14. So if we can get within the school system and reach a large number of students and educate on lifestyle factors like exercise, sleep and diet, and how we can modify our behaviour to help prevent mental disorders, it's so much more effective than trying to treat them down 10, 20 years down the track. Reduces the burden on the health system, but I just think it's my public health, I think, passion coming back in there as well. I think the prevention option is far more greater. And it's also great working with kids as well. They love it. They get excited. It's something new that they haven't heard about. So when you talk to them about the gut microbiota and mental health, like, it's something they can change. Whereas all these other factors, like their schoolwork, their home life, if they're all having a burden on mental health, sometimes kids can feel a bit helpless. So talking to them about these things that they're actually able to modify, I think can, yeah, quite light them up, and it's pretty positive. So hopefully, yeah, research, maybe some research studies in that area, or continuing on that science translation work. So science communication I quite find interesting too. So we do all this research a lot of the time and no one gets to see it. So I think it's something like 17 years from when a research study is published to when it's actually been translated a lot of the time, or where the practice changes after that. So trying to shorten that gap between research and practice, I think, yeah, it's a cool space to be in as well.
Now we'll move on to our third and final section of the podcast, where we'll get you to look back a bit and give some advice for students and graduates who may be looking to pursue a career in, you're in the field of nutritional psychiatry. So how, I think you've described so well what your day-to-day life looks like. So I think we can probably, unless there was anything you wanted to add about what a day in the life of a nutritional psychiatry research dietitian, that is a
I know, it's a one. You've done well. I'm impressed with that. I'm not too sure if there's anything that would differ substantially to day in the life of other researchers. It really differs depending whether you're working on clinical trial research or other research. I think working in the space of nutrition research is interesting because it's so fast changing though as well. So that's probably, it's a bit more of an exciting field in terms of that. And then working with, I think with the mental health population is a bit unique in that I find them to be very, very interested in adopting and learning new ideas, because a lot of these patients are often treatment resistant, where they've found that antidepressants and things like that haven't worked. So I think even changing one small part of these people's lives who are quite desperate and quite disheartened is, yeah, it can be quite rewarding.
Have you had any kind of colleagues or people that, you know, did a PhD in the field of nutritional psychiatry, is an option then to say go and specialize as a, you know, private practice dietitian in nutritional psychiatry? Like, is that, or is that still quite, you know, emerging?
It's not something, so we call the field nutritional psychiatry in terms of research, but in terms of the field, it'd probably be more just working in the field of mental health. There's no specific nutritional psychiatry. I mean, some in London, I think there's a couple of psychiatrists who are specializing in nutrition. They call themselves nutritional psychiatrists. But there's no, like, if you wanted to specialize in private practice, it'd probably be more around specializing in mental health, per se, if that makes sense. Yeah.
And why do you think nutritional psychiatry is an important area of nutrition?
For me, I think it's so important because we know that, I suppose, mental disorders are the leading burden of health issues across the globe. And you find, even as a dietitian, if you had someone who presented with diabetes or heart disease, these conditions are so commonly comorbid with a mental disorder. So if you don't have a mental disorder yourself, you probably have a family member or a friend who's experienced anxiety, depression, something so prevalent. So I think because they're so widespread, having knowledge on how you may be able to play a small part in improving the lives of these people as a dietitian is quite powerful. And I think it is such a unique area. We're finding more and more out every day. The research is rapidly coming out. So for instance, at the Food and Mood Centre, we'll soon have data from the Healthy Parents, Healthy Kids study, where one of the researchers looked at how modifying a mother's diet when she was pregnant, how that could change the gut microbiota of the mother, but also the offspring of her children as well. So looking at the links between that and mental health, so looking not only at adults now, but also at mothers and their children is really exciting. So it's something that can be taught and educated across the lifespan potentially as well.
And are there any misconceptions that you'd like to address about working in research? I know we spoke a bit earlier about, you know, this misconception that researchers don't work with people, they just sit in front of a computer all day. Is there, yeah, would you like to speak to that?
Yeah, I think that's a huge misconception, particularly if you're working in clinical trials. You see participants on a day-to-day basis in most instances. And I think a lot, research is so flexible. I think that's something that draws me to it, like the flexible lifestyle, the flexible hours, but also the flexibility to take ownership of it and where you want to. So we do a lot of work at the Food and Mood Centre on research translation, as I mentioned. So that involves going out to the community and talking one-on-one or to large groups about the research as well. So it's not just sitting in a white lab coat from day to day and holding a pipette. I do find it really stimulating. I probably still wouldn't be here now after 3 years if I didn't. So I do really enjoy it. It has its challenges, but there's a lot of computer work, but at the same time, it is rewarding to see patients or participants as well.
Did you ever consider kind of taking more of, say, a psychology route and kind of being a psychologist that specializes in issues relating to food? Like, because you have that clinical, clinical experience as well as a dietitian. Like, was there any part of you that considered that, or was, we're just interested to kind of look at lots of different areas because nutrition is so, it's so multidisciplinary. Just interested.
No, I think that's good. And psychology is so entwined in every facet of eating, isn't it? So I think having more, even in our undergrads, about psychology and the psychology of eating, I think would be intuitive even, for example, would be so fascinating. For me, it never crossed my mind because, as I said, I kind of stumbled into this type of research. And I knew as well that the Food and Mood Centre is a world leading research centre for this area. So I thought, for me, if I was going to learn anything, it'd be probably the best place to learn. But though my partner won't be happy me saying this, it'll be never say never to learning some more after this. So who sees down the track, it might be something that could be done.
Just on that, about we've spoken about the Food and Mood Centre quite a few times in this conversation. So mm-hmm. Can you just tell us a bit about that? Because we're Monash students. I have heard of it. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about that. And who are they, all dietitians who work there, or how does that work?
So as I mentioned, it's located in Geelong, but we have, I suppose, members of PhD candidates and postdoc researchers in Melbourne, and honorary members, say, in Finland as well. So it is a research centre as part of Deakin University. And it's definitely not just dietitians. I mean, we have people with IT backgrounds. So one of their PhD candidates has recently developed an app on food and mood so that can be used online by people. It's not available yet. We're going to be using it as part of future research studies. But it helps provide more accessible information so that you're not having to see a dietitian one-on-one. A lot of people can't afford to see a dietitian one-on-one, and particularly with no Medicare rebate for items such as mental disorders at the moment, it is quite costly. So yeah, we're utilising the app. So IT skills are quite big within the Food and Mood Centre. We have nutrition researchers, nutrition science backgrounds. So not necessarily dietitians, but nutrition scientists who have come out, done an honours and then gone into a PhD. What else do we have? We have psychologists. I hope I'm not leaving anyone else out, but yeah, it's quite broad. So you don't have to be a dietitian. Some aspect of nutrition knowledge is useful, but the beauty of working in such a multidisciplinary team is if you don't have that skill, someone else there will. So if you just marry up together, work on a project together, and yeah.
That leads really well to the question I was just about to ask, which was, does your dietetic training kind of, do you still use that in your field now? Or do you think for students who are listening to this conversation thinking, that's like, I'd love to go and do research in that field, is dietetic training the best step? Because now, I'm pretty sure it's the same at Deakin, the dietetics is actually a master's, so you don't have to, not that you had to do it, but it's not intertwined in the course that you did.
Mm-hmm. I have found it really incredibly useful. Even my clinical experience, even though it was short, I think it gave me a great understanding of really complex health issues and the management of those, which I think I'm a better researcher and dietitian for that. And I think definitely, even just when you're talking, say my paper or the research I'm doing on fermented dairy, even just understanding the nuances of like nutrition that you really get from that dietetic.
Just to follow on from Charlotte's, for students who are doing research units, either in their undergrad or postgrad, mm-hmm. In nutrition and dietetics, how can they make the most of their research units if they are looking to get into this field?
Well, I think, do you have the opportunity to pick your own topic? I mean, if you could pick the topic that you're doing, and then it's hard without knowing what type of research you're doing. I mean, I wouldn't get too caught up on the stat side of things if you don't get them. You work with a statistician a lot of the time within PhDs as well. So I was pretty hopeless at stats. I do remember though, we did have a research project and you had the opportunity to do, say, a quantitative study, a qualitative study, or a mixed method. So you could do quant and qual together.
And yeah, we're doing that now.
Yeah, and for some reason I chose to do quant and qual together. And at the time I was like, why have I done this to myself? This is a nightmare. But I've recently, so I work as a research assistant as well with a food, like Food and Mood Centre, one day a week. And I recently used that and I was analysing qualitative results for this project. So I thought back to that. I was like, gosh, I'm so glad that I said yes to that then. So otherwise I'd have no idea. So I think trying to just learn and do as many different things as possible is really useful in your undergrad, because yeah, you never know where it's going to pop back up. Like for me, I thought I'd never touch qual data again, but here I am a couple of years down the track. So I hope that answers that.
Yeah, sure. Thank you.
That's all right.
A student is interested in, say, pursuing a career, maybe just in research broadly. You talked a bit about, you know, how you did you intern or you kind of assisted with the Miles trial. So, what are some steps that, you know, students could take during their studies to maybe put them in a better position to then go into research?
I think if you find something that interests you, you always probably have a 50-50 chance of someone responding, but it can't hurt to send an email and to reach out to people. That being said, always look for opportunities that are going to benefit you, not just be one-sided. I think sometimes students might work themselves into the ground trying to help people and they're really not getting much out of that for themselves. So think of how the opportunity is going to benefit you and don't just blindly say yes for the sake of it, because sometimes you might find yourself doing hours and hours of just admin stuff and anyone can do that. It's not going to really benefit your dietetic skills. So ask the right questions at the start of taking on any internship or...
Yeah, I think we can definitely get caught up in you know, just saying, trying to get every single opportunity and, you know, it is, yeah, I think that's great.
Yeah, and you want to be authentic to yourself as well. And if you are going to get asked about these experiences down the track as part of an interview, if you haven't learned much, but you've got all this on your resume, it's going to maybe, I don't know, it's not going to add much to getting jobs, securing jobs or forming relationships if you haven't enjoyed it or learnt much from it. So although it's good to say yes to every opportunity, you can get kind of caught up in saying yes and then you're left with thinking, okay, why have I done this? I've got to do my work now as my uni work. I've got to do paid work and it just becomes too much and overburdensome. So I think being a little bit strategic and selectively picking a couple of things that might set you apart, but I think it's quality over quantity at the end of the day.
And regardless of the field, what is one skill that you think nutrition students could focus on learning that would complement their more of academic study?
I think it'd have to absolutely be communication skills. I think whether that's writing or even speaking, because you can have the best ideas, but if you can't communicate them effectively, then you're kind of left with nothing at the end of the day. So getting those opportunities, even just presenting in class. I remember we had to do lots of orals and things like that. And the more you do, the better you are. I mean, at the start, when I was first doing a lot of community presentations, I was shocking. I'd hate to watch back and see what I was saying for a lot of those, but you build your confidence. And the more you write and things like that as well, the better you get. So communication skills, I think, are important in no matter what field you're in.
Absolutely. And what has been a highlight of your career so far, and what are you most proud of?
Ooh, I don't know really. I sometimes when you think about your own career, you find that you're not very interesting, although others might find it interesting.
I disagree.
I think research the perks of traveling. So last year I got to go to London and New Zealand, which sounds crazy. It feels like a lifetime ago now. So taking those opportunities and being able to travel has been really good. I think I am proud of the work I've done, particularly working with students to date. So working within a school capacity, I find that really rewarding, and being able to get feedback from students about how they've found it really useful has been good. And I suppose making that jump from clinical to research, it was really daunting at the time, but I think I'm proud that I've made the right step for me and back to myself in, even though it wasn't probably on the career trajectory that seems to be more normal for dietitians, but I think it's really worked in my favour.
This is one of, I think, Tiana and I's favourite questions to ask is, can you give us an elevator pitch for why listeners should consider pursuing a career in nutritional psychiatry?
I think I've already touched on this, but I think if you can make one small change to a person's life through changing one small thing, which you can do through nutrition in terms of the impact on mental health, I think that can speak wonders in terms of change in someone's life. So for me, I think the potential to, this is very long elevator, isn't it, right? for me, to be able to impact someone's life through changing a small thing such as someone's diet, I think is what has drawn me to this field, particularly people who are really struggling and sometimes have lost all faith. So yeah, for me, that's why mental health is really important for nutrition researchers.
Love it. And just to wrap up, what is a bite or sort of pearl of wisdom that you could give to current nutrition students and graduates?
I think stay calm. Don't stress that you need everything figured out. I certainly don't. And I'm a 30 PhD student. So just try to, I suppose, do as much as you can now. Learn as much as you can in terms of getting different experiences. And then, yeah, life always seems to have a way of working itself out. So I wouldn't get too caught up in knowing exactly what your niche is now or what you're going to do when you finish. Just, I think what you girls are doing is amazing with the podcast and really setting yourselves apart and learning all these different skills by podcasting. So yeah, try new things.
Yeah, I think that's very comforting to know that, you know, you don't have to have a, and that's a common theme throughout these conversations, is that, you know, a phone call can happen, an email, you meet someone, it just can change the course of your career.
And people always talk about the importance of networking, and I'm not a big networker per se. I get a bit squirmish and, oh, you've got to network with people. But just the idea of talking to people, being authentic, and if you're in a scenario, just speaking to people, asking genuine questions, I think to me is more, it's not networking, I suppose it is in the sense, but just doing it authentically. I think you never know where a conversation is going to lead you. And for me, that's led to where I am now, to doing a PhD. So, yeah.
And just to wrap up, we have two questions that we ask all of our guests at the end of each episode. The first one being, where do you see nutrition going in the future?
I think, so coming out of a conference I went to at London last year, this area of personalized nutrition is really growing. So it's called the Zoe Project in London. And what they're doing is collecting microbiome samples, so gut microbiota samples. And I think they're also measuring blood glucose levels and measuring, predicting people's responses to food. So the researcher there was talking about, he was always having, it was Tim Spector, Professor Tim Spector. He was having a tuna sandwich for lunch every day, thinking this is the best thing for him. It's whole grain tuna, healthy fats. This is surely going to be better for him than a big bowl of spaghetti bolognese with lots of pasta, small amounts of meats. But what he found after measuring his blood glucose response was that, in fact, his blood glucose levels were more stable after eating that bowl of pasta than his whole grain tuna sandwich. So I think what we eat, although we have these very general specific nutrition guidelines, we're also individualized. So in the future, maybe having those technologies where we can predict what foods and meals are going to be better for us is really exciting, and I'm hoping to see more research in that space in the next couple of years.
And finally, what is your next bite or the next project that you're working on?
So for me, my next bite will be, what am I working on? I feel like research can be slow sometimes. I'm still in the knee deep of working in the clinical trial data, looking at my next probably bite would be publishing data relating to that fermented and unfermented dairy paper and depression. And then also looking at maybe developing a program where we can educate school teachers on the importance of diet and mental health for students. So a little bit more bigger picture stuff, and hopefully being able to impact a few more students that way. So we'll see. Watch this space. We might be able to develop something in the next year, which will be exciting.
Thank you so much, Meg. This has just been such an incredible hour and a great way to wrap up the whole season. I think you're just, yeah, so interesting in the way that your career has unfolded, and just that you've taken these opportunities and made the most of it, and just kind of, yeah, I really like that you kind of haven't started off with a very specific plan. You've just met people and being quite authentic, and that's how, like, I just think that's so inspiring as students, and I think you've got a very grounding presence as well. I feel so calm.
Thank you. I feel like, yeah, it's important to pivot. Some might say I don't have very clear goals or things like that, but it's just a pivoting, I think, as well, and then finding something that interests you, going with that, because we don't all have the one career these days. People jump from career to career. So find what interests you at the time, stick with that, give that a go. And then don't get so caught up in you have to be here by a specific timeline. I think for me, just going with the ride has been something I've really enjoyed so far. But thanks for the opportunity to speak.
Thank you so much for tuning in to this episode of The Next Bite with the incredible Meg Hockey. Meg just gave such an incredible rundown of the whole research experience, and she is doing it in real time, which I think was just so insightful to hear. Now, this Meg actually marks our final episode, our final guest of season two, but we have one more kind of special little bite-sized episode to come. We're going to record it after exams, so just wishing all of the nutrition students the best of luck with their exams, and we will be back in your ears following that sometime in December.